Welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast, the podcast for artists who mean business. Here's your host, Antrese Wood.
Hey, it's Antrese, and welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. You regular listeners have noticed already, I'm a day late on this. Actually, a little bit more than a day late, technically. I went down to San Diego to visit a friend of mine. You might remember Donna Moritz from one of the episodes here, and she was in from Australia. And I thought I could finish this episode up while I was on the road, and it turns out I was wrong about that. So I am so sorry. It's Friday afternoon, and I'm just getting this out. My guest today is Deborah Hughes. Deborah is a plein air painter from Southern California. She lives in Orange County, where she has a studio and a gallery on Balboa Island. Deborah's work has been featured in Art of the West and Plein Air magazine. This year, her paintings will be exhibited in the Maui Plein Air and at the California Art Club Gold Medal Exhibition at the Autry Museum. In this episode, Deborah and I talk about what she teaches her students about simplification and avoiding the overwhelm of complicated subjects. She talks about how she started her own gallery and admitting what you're not good at and delegating the rest. That's something I could definitely learn to do. We also talk about the mistakes that artists make when dealing with a gallery and the many plein air events that she participates in and how she uses that consistency to move her work. So we're just going to jump right in. Here is Deborah Hughes. Hi, Deborah. Thank you so much for being on the show with me. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Yes, thank you. I'm thrilled to be on.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you started out as an artist and when you began to focus on painting as your primary vocation?
Well, sure. I'm really lucky because my mom was a painter, and I was often, you know, watching everything she was doing very young. So she got me doing my own little canvases and pens and ink and, you know, watercolor and all sorts of things right along with her when I was really young, besides coloring. And so I advanced really quickly as far as that goes, and I was fortunate to have her. She worked in every medium you can think of and was not a professional, but we have a lot of her paintings that are really beautiful. And so I took it seriously kind of right from the beginning. And I was fortunate in sixth grade to have also a really neat art teacher, Mrs. Sissel. And she was cool. And she was involved with John Heron School of Art, which is in Indianapolis, which is where I grew up. And Indianapolis, Indiana. And she was able each year to award one male and one female sixth grader to go to college courses at John Heron Art Institute. And so I worked very hard to win that and was so thrilled when I got to go in sixth grade, so I think you're about 12, mm-hmm. for the whole summer. And I could take any of the college courses that I wanted to take.
Wow.
It was the coolest thing. I had my own locker. I mean, it was just, it gives me chills right now just to remember.
Yeah, because you feel like such a grown-up, right? Like
totally. It was just beyond words, really. And that was a huge impact. And so, of course, after that, I took everything very seriously. And I did do a lot of different kinds of paintings. But even in that John Heron Art Institute, they let us do printmaking, even the nude model, painting, ceramics, I mean, pretty much anything we wanted to. It was fantastic.
Wow.
It's quite an inspiration.
That must have been incredible. Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised. Well, I'm not. When you said that, I was thinking, like, I wonder about the life drawing classes, if they let a sixth grader in there.
They did.
That's so cool that they did.
They did. It was really neat. I mean, you're just so feeling like an adult, you know, at 12. It's hard to even believe. And so there's no time to, you know, I guess, worry about anything like that. You just want to get in there and do something and act like, you know, like you're cool, you know. So, and right around that same time, maybe even right before that, my mom knew an artist down the street. I just remember her last name was McKittrick. And she was a professional artist working from her home like we are now, or from her studio. And her husband was an architect, so they had the coolest house on the block. And I did go to her house for lessons. And she had me start off by stretching my own canvases and then painting still lifes that were started with just a basket of oranges. But one of them had, you know, a crazy design on a tablecloth and vases that you could see through and all sorts of really
challenging
things, very challenging. And so I actually still have some of those paintings. And so, you know, I was really brought up to be a professional artist the whole way along, seems like.
Wow. That's so cool. I love how supportive your parents were in getting you out and getting you into all these courses. Was there an artist that you admired when you were young that really inspired you?
Well, besides my mom, of course, and my grandmother also did some really cool, beautiful drawings. My mom and grandmother always took me to the Indianapolis Art Museum, and we would go have lunch and we would go look at the Impressionists. Mm. So I was like being really brought along all the way from a young child, I guess, since they saw the interest. And so I was super impressed by the Impressionists, Degas, Monet, Mary Cassatt.
Do you remember a specific painting?
Well, the Seurat paintings, you know, with the pointillism, mm-hmm. and the Degas paintings with the ballet dancers, mm. and Manet type paintings with the, you know, water lilies. And so all of it was just Monet was very impressive.
Was there a moment or a decision that you made in your career that you feel like was a personal success, something that you look back on now and are really glad that you did it?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is kind of along the lines where we just were, as that is in college. I was taking college courses for, you know, art, graphic design and painting and the whole thing kind of, and photography and everything to look for a personal, you know, career. And at one point, though, I was really bothered by the fact of the languages that I had to take in order to stay in the art program. And I was very intimidated by, you know, how hard they seemed to be. And I was also interested in business. So I called up my dad from college and said, I'm going to change my major, Dad. I'm going to change my major to business. I'm going to go to the business school. My brother went through the business school. He's a very successful entrepreneur in restaurant business. And my father's self-employed. And so we kind of had both things going in the family. And I said that to him, and there's this long pause, and he goes, absolutely not. You're staying in art school.
Wow.
I know. Just the opposite of what you would expect a dad to say.
Right.
So at that point, I'm like, okay, so German was next on my list. So I ich spreche Deutsch and stayed in art school. So that was a really big turning point to make sure I wasn't, you know, heading up a corporation instead.
And how do you look at, did you learn anything from that? You know, because it sounds like as a young college student, and I remember having those moments where I panic and call home and be like, what am I doing? Oh, yeah. My God. But did you, looking back now at who you were at age, you know, 20-something, what do you think you learned from that experience? Besides just the kind of obvious of, I'm an artist now because I didn't change.
Well, yeah, sticking with it too, and not abandoning something when you're scared. So that happens to us almost every day when we paint.
Yes.
Which is pretty funny, you know. And I remember when I switched from studio painting to plein air painting, that was a very important turning point too. And I found that the overwhelming sensation of being outdoor on location could make you feel like, I can't do this. I'm putting this in the trash and I'm going to go home.
Right.
And so those two times were, I specifically remember that with painting too, were important because I learned that when you do stick with it, you know, it's not as terrible. You just got to calm yourself down and keep going. And then all of a sudden things turn out to be way better than you ever anticipated. And that happened with the in college and how I ended up progressing in the career, and then also happened in painting when I first, you know, actually stuck with a painting that I absolutely hated because of fear and worry that I couldn't possibly do it. And it turned out to end up being one of my very favorite paintings. And that's like, wow, I just learned a lot, you know, from that. So sticking with things and having the fortitude to push past the fear really makes a big difference. I think every artist runs into that every day in all sorts of ways, whether it's entering shows. Or,
absolutely.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, you get better at dealing with it. I was just, you know, kind of, I participated in the sort of informal challenge of how many things can you do during the course of a day that make you really uncomfortable?
Oh.
And it was a tough week, but I learned a lot about myself because I was paying so much attention to that. And also got a lot of stuff done. I mean, it's a really interesting thing to try to find ways to push yourself to grow like that.
So did you plan to spend a whole week, and did you make a list of things that you hate doing or that make you uncomfortable? Well, how did you do that?
it was just like with a group of friends. It was kind of a competition who could, you know, at the end of the week, who got the most points for doing, you know, uncomfortable things. So every day I would just list out, you know, the things that I did. And in the morning I would kind of go like, okay, at first it was kind of easy because it was like, what am I avoiding? And so then I did those things, and some of it was just personal things. Like, one of the things that I thought was really funny is something that my husband kind of, gets on me a little bit about, which is we had, gone to a restaurant, and I was really, really tired that day. It had been a very, very long day. And so we went to a restaurant just wanting a nice, quiet dinner. And we walked in, and I was, you know, I was chit chat with the hostess, and so I said, you know, like, I'm really tired. I don't think we're going to sit in the bar today because it's too noisy. I really want a quiet table. And she's like, oh, okay, good. And she sits us next to this table that had three adults and about seven kids under the age of seven, I think.
Oh, real nice.
Yeah. And you know, For a table with seven kids, they were behaving themselves very, very well. It's just that that's not the night that I wanted to have or pay for. And so we asked to move tables. You know, I'm the type of person that at first I was like, okay, it's fine, I'll deal with it. You know, we ordered drinks, and then I was just like, after about 5 minutes, I'm like, I'm not gonna deal with this. I can't, this is not gonna be fun. And so we asked to move tables, and they couldn't. And so we left, even though we'd already ordered. And that is something I would normally never do because I would feel so guilty. But at the same time, I was just like,
okay, Noy, Antrese, you're talking about pushing yourself to do things that you don't want to do, but you couldn't sit there with those seven kids.
That's oh, that's right.
That's well, pretty hilarious.
Well, I think that, you know, the point is like, doing stuff that's,
out of the ordinary. Or...
out of the order. And it's not to torture yourself.
Oh, okay. Cause that's what I thought it was. And I was dying to know which was the most torturous event that you participated in. It sounds like we found it.
No, but yeah. And there was like a bunch of stuff like that of, putting yourself out there and reaching out and contacting people or doing things that make you, you know, that will move you forward, but don't, that just you wouldn't normally do or that you're very uncomfortable doing.
So you're talking about the everyday life of an artist.
Yeah. And you know? And so, yeah, so like all those things that, you know, like getting your work out there or like you're saying, and here's a question that I have for you is, you know, I know when I started plein air painting, there was a lot of things that when you're first starting, you're so self-conscious and it makes you hyper aware of everything that's going on around you. But do you remember when you made that switch from the studio into plein air painting and you get out there to do your first plein air painting. How did you feel? Like, what was it, you know, do you remember what the things were that made you uncomfortable?
Well, the very first one, I went out into a big Back Bay estuary with a group of people that ended up being the Laguna Plein Air Painters eventually.
Uh-huh.
And I went to paint with pastel, and, you know, I did okay, and I had fun. I thought it wasn't so bad. Then the second time I went out was with another group of painters, and we went to Balboa Island, which is where area that I'm from here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's full of all sorts of boats and walkways and houses and piers and, you know, all sorts of pilings and things everywhere.
Very
and
complicated compositions.
Super, yes, it was so, so overwhelming. And actually, I remember I was out painting with Jeff Horn, and you probably know him.
Uh-huh.
And I asked him, you know, don't you get really stressed out when you're out here painting? And he looked at me like, no. because, and it happens with all my students now, you know, how do you possibly go out and look at all of this stuff and figure out what to get into a painting? And so I certainly remember that. And that, you know, ties back to that first time where I really wanted to throw my painting away because it's just so overwhelming. It's like, oh my God, how can you possibly? And now in my workshops, I teach people how to get over that fear. And actually how I did in that particular case was to start working 6x8 size instead of anything bigger, because it seems like everyone thinks they have to take out a pretty big canvas because it's a pretty big scene and they better get all of the information into that scene. So then you figure, well, I need a really big canvas because there's a lot of detail, you know, and really that's the opposite of what you should be doing. You should be going out to these complicated places with the smallest canvas and just making yourself get in the big pieces.
Mm-hmm. So the smallest canvas and the biggest brush.
Yes. And I found that once I just said, okay, Deb, now just get the, you know, sky, get the distant landmass, the water, and the foreground. You know, four things. You can do that. Okay, so I do that. Okay, now maybe add some boats in the distance there. Make sure you get the light right, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm like, hey, look at that. I got a painting and not very much time, you know, and it actually looks good because I had time to think about value, shape, composition, and no detail. Because there was not room for detail on this little painting.
Right.
And so once I started learning how to take that approach, everything was so much easier. So that's how I teach all my workshops. Same thing. Try to understand the big shapes, you know, because composition, design, value, all that stuff is so important. And if you're so overwhelmed with all these things, then you're not thinking about the things you should be thinking about. So,
right. Right.
Yeah. So that was a big score to figure that out.
Yeah, and that's huge too, because for some reason we want to think that complicated is better, but it's in a way it's so much harder to be simple because you have to edit and curate and decide what shapes are important, mm-hmm. which ones aren't, and you know what is that aggregate color of all those shades of green in that, you know, in that mountainside, and is it even green, you know?
Right, and is it important to get all those shades, and you know, what is it you're trying to say? And so working small is really helpful because you know, people don't realize how much you have to think often. I find artists that are, you know, coming along and they're struggling somewhat that they are not realizing how much they have to think about the big pieces and the small piece and the values and the shapes like we were just discussing,
mm-hmm.
you know, in order to have success.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't just walk up and look around and start willy-nilly, you know. This is what I see all the time is people willy-nilly just painting whatever they see. They're looking left, they're looking right, and their paintbrush keeps moving. But
mm-hmm.
they don't know what they're painting because they really don't know what they're doing, and they just hope it will magically appear. And so, you know, it's really important to have a plan and think about things and really, you know, stop from that.
Yeah, and I think also it has to do with the amount of experience that you have. And by that I mean when you are first doing anything, but, you know, especially with painting, you're getting all this information, you know, in this case it's visual information. And you have to know what to pay attention to and what to disregard, which is that simplification process. But once you learn, you know, what your, you know, priorities are, mm-hmm. then it's really easy to start and to finish a painting and to know what to pay attention to in those simple shapes. And so once you can ignore 80% of the stimulus,
exactly,
the rest is easy.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know, easy, but
it's not easy, but it's much more enjoyable. It's much more enjoyable, I would say, you know, because you simplify. And there's a term, less is more, is so popular, because, and the more you simplify and make a simple statement, it's even in a tree. You know, I remember painting with my friend Libby Tolley, and we were out painting in San Luis Obispo and the big giant eucalyptus trees. And, you know, she said, the best way I found to paint these trees is to just do it almost in two values. You do the dark value, the part that's straight up and down, that's not catching any light. And then you group the shape on top of the light and just keep it, you know, strong and simple. Mm-hmm. And if you approach everything, really think about it, if you're doing a field of poppies, you look at Ray Roberts' paintings of fields of poppies. Mm-hmm. Or Jesse Powell, or, you know, any of the wonderful, you know, Granville Redman or whoever, you need to group and find the shape and design of the flowers. And once you start to understand things like that, you know, you kind of have some tools in your pocket in order to end up with a successful painting. So whether it's glitter on the water, the light on a tree, the flowers in a field, or even on a bush. You don't want to have lots of little polka dots on your tree or on your bush or in your field. You want to have groups of flowers and then maybe one or two things that say, oh, these are poppies, or these are lupin, or this is roses, or, you know what I mean, if you're mm-hmm. doing a landscape. And so simplifying is, and unifying shapes is so important. So there's a lot to think about once you get past being overwhelmed with all the detail, and you want to, you know, really get down to the nuts and bolts. It's going to make you come along a lot faster, and it's, and will help you do better paintings. It's like a Ken Oster, you know, everybody loved Ken Oster, and he was a great painter, and he, you know, really talked about the intelligence of painting, mm-hmm. and that you really have to think about what you're doing every step of the way and have a plan and stick with it. So
yeah, such a huge loss.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just threw that in there. I mean, if people don't know who Ken Oster is, he was an amazing painter and a wonderful human being, and he recently mm-hmm. passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You can look up his paintings and see how strong they are, and you know, he was all about that. Well, and that's, you know, all, you get little tidbits from everyone that you work with.
Yeah.
You could pick up something finally. You've heard this 100 times, but finally now with so-and-so you're painting with, you go, oh, now I see what you're saying, you know, and I understand more how to apply it. Now I can think about it.
Right.
So just have to, a little bit here, a little bit there, and each time, you know, you'll grow. And that's why we can never stop learning as painters, because every time we paint something, we learn another, oh,
yeah.
That.
Yeah. Or you have enough information to be able to, you know, take something that somebody is telling you to a different level. And also, I mean, it happens so many times that people can tell you, you can hear something 10, 20 times, and then all of a sudden you just get it.
Totally.
And it could be the 100th explanation, it can be the 3rd explanation. You know, sometimes it's just whether you're at that moment able to receive it. It could be the mm-hmm. method of delivery, whatever. But yeah, it's a constant, never-ending learning process. But that's why I'm so in love with it.
Oh, I know. I had a lot of fun last month in one of my workshops. I took everybody outside. I said, okay, I think we were talking about value. Yeah. And so, you know, what color is white in the sun and what color is white in the shade? So we started walking around the neighborhood, and I'm looking, okay, look at this house. Here's white trim in the sun. Now look at the white trim in the shade. It's like a, you know, a lavender, a gray, a bluish. It can be any color, but look on your value scale in your hand. Look how the value of the white that's in the shadow is actually darker when you squint than even a green tree in the sunshine. Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting. That really opened everybody's eyes. I had never done that before, but seeing some things that are real on, you know, and have it walking around going, oh, I go, oh, here's a good one. You know, here's a boat in the water. It's got a black motor on the boat. And the black in the sun is lighter
than the white in the shadow.
The white in the shadow over there, the shadow of the boat. And if you squint down, sure enough, you can see it. And they're all holding a value scale in their hand. And I've never heard more, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so that was fun. Rather than looking at paintings or pictures, you know, to actually go out in real life and say, this is what I'm talking about. Look at it. It's right there for your eyes. You can see it.
Yeah.
You know? And so yeah.
I think I had that experience with a white and black cow. Yeah. I was just like, oh my, I can finally see it. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Same to thing. Do that.
Yeah.
Good that's stuff. So cool. I love those moments. So can you tell me, how do you choose your subject matter? What do you look for when you're out searching for a place to paint?
Well, when I'm on location, I'm looking for the light and hopefully some kind of drama and then some focal point. I like to work with focal points. So I call that kind of like my hook.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's going to be in one of the four golden zones that if you've heard of that, I mean, I'm sure you have, but so if some other artists, you know, don't know about that, you can divide your canvas, you know, into three ways and you get four points that intersect. And those points are good for design to put a focal point so that your focal point doesn't end up off the side of the canvas or in the middle of the canvas. So even when I'm working in my studio on a giant painting, I still do that. And I still find those golden zones and I still try to put my hook or my focal point or something that I think is the coolest part. And I set it, whether it's, you know, top left, bottom right, wherever, and I plan for that. And so I'd say that makes a really big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
So I look for the light, you know, whether you have to decide then, oh, do you want to talk about the fog? You know, so then there's hardly any values. And how do I do that? That's a cool challenge because it looks really hard to paint.
Uh-huh.
And if I can paint the fog and still have a focal point and still have a little bit of color in the foreground, and then it all goes to grays. And can I, you know, get away with this or not? And so it also has to be something that intrigues me. Oh, can I capture the light on those distant hills and get the colors to not all be gray? So there might be a lavender hill, but how do I get the light on the lavender hill, you know, so that it looks slightly to the green and, you know, just different
yeah.
things like that. Little things that are gentle, little beautiful changes. That, you know, everything can excite you, but you still have to have some kind of a plan and a hook.
Uh-huh.
If you just paint something because you think, oh, this is pretty, you might not realize what you're painting is all in full sunlight maybe. And so it might
right.
make for a rather flat painting because there's no modeling of form because the light source, you know, isn't in the right place. So you always want to, and I'm always going, okay, I like this subject. Okay, I see light and I see shadow. So I want to make sure I can see both. And then I always check to see where the sun is going to go. So I have a plan.
As it's moving while you're painting.
Yeah, always start with my darks and my shadows so that I don't change that. So even as the sun now is coming across and there's light on the right side of the boat, for instance, and dark on the left side of the boat, as the sun starts coming across, all of a sudden it switches, you know, and sometimes people don't realize it and they're changing their painting and changing their painting.
Right. You're chasing the light and you're like, you've got one part of your painting that is at one angle and the other part that you finished 2 hours later, you have a completely different light source and you can't figure out why. It just doesn't look right.
Yeah. So that's where having a plan and being an intelligent painter and thinking about what you're going to do, making a plan and sticking with it is so important.
Mm.
And once you kind of go, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It takes a lot of stress away because you aren't going, no, wait, that didn't look right. That didn't look
yeah.
right. You know what your plan is.
Yeah.
And so you just keep moving forward and filling in all your big pieces and then starting to refine. But you have a plan and it's a much more relaxed and enjoyable way to, you know, approach a painting. And just takes a while to get that figured out. Once
yeah.
you do, that's the ticket.
So, Deborah, you also have your own gallery. Can you tell me a little bit about how you made the decision to add that into your foray, into your schedule and business
yeah.
and all that? Because I'm sure it's...
I must have been insane when it came up. But when I was okay, I was doing graphic design for a while, and I was an art director in an advertising agency and painting at night. And I've been showing and painting since I was in high school. And so even when I was doing my graphic design and to make money, got to start with money, you know, I was still always painting and showing at places. So as I'm doing that, I've moved from Indianapolis to California. Uh-huh. Because I got a job at an ad agency as an art director. It's like, great job. And now I'm in Southern California and the light is all wonderful and I'm beside myself. It's great. So I met a gentleman that you know very well, John Cosby. I think I had an interview with him, as a matter of fact. And so he has always been a friend ever since I moved here. And I used to just take him to lunch. Can I take you to lunch? You know, I liked his work. I mean, I loved his work and him. He's a nice guy. And, you know, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what you're doing and what I should be doing and stuff like that? And so I have to say, thanks a lot, John. he said, if you can ever put your name on the front of an art gallery, do it. And because at the time he had art galleries called John Cosby Gallery. Uh-huh. And so I was doing graphic design in this cute building on Balboa Island upstairs. And the guy in the office next to me did copywriting. We traded, hired each other for jobs all the time. And he had the downstairs as an art gallery. And it was kind of never open. And he was only kind of half serious about it. So I started asking him, can I show my work down there? And he said, sure. So, do you mind if I open it on the weekends? Sure. So then he found a building in Laguna Beach and moved his whole business to Laguna Beach. And now I had the decision, am I going to move or am I going to take over this entire lease of this whole building upstairs and downstairs? Mm. And I know. And so I talked to the landlord and she was so sweet. She said, oh, you know, just give it a try, sweetie. We'll be here for you. So I said, okay, I want to, you know, give it a whirl.
And this is in Newport Beach?
Yeah, it's in Newport Beach on Balboa Island. And that was in 1998. So we're on year 18. I can't believe it.
Wow.
I know. And so what I started with was having it as my studio and my gallery and showing my work. Excuse me. And then I started inviting people that I admired to come have a show and a workshop. So I started with Ken Backus. Then I invited John Budison. And now we have Randall Sexton, Calvin Liang, Kim Lordier, Calvin,
really great painters. You know,
Jim McVicker. All sorts of really great painters. Colin Page. So I meet them at other shows. I really like them and I really like their work. And I say, you know, Lori Putnam, she and I have gotten to be really good friends. And Lori, I love your work and I love you. Why don't you come to Balboa Island and we'll teach a workshop and have a show, you know? She's one of our featured artists also. So it's worked out and now it's kind of hamster wheel that keeps running. But the part that's good is I got Linda Johnson in there as director 15 years ago or so. And she started just doing some sales. And now we've worked it out so that she handles everything for the gallery so that I can focus on my painting and getting her paintings and then focus on, I do a lot of plein air events. Uh-huh. You know, I try to enter all the national shows. So I have two jobs. So I kind of oversee what she does and we work together on that. But she's really good at handling the clients and the art, and she's an artist, so she's very knowledgeable, and so that works out really cool. And that allows me to be able to paint and do what I'm meant to do, which is not run a gallery, but to paint.
Right. I also interviewed another woman who is an artist and runs a gallery, so I'm kind of fascinated by this. But I guess what I'm curious about is, I'm sure you had your ideas and perceptions, you know, when John said you should try to get your name on a gallery. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of describe what you met at that point when you had to decide, I'm going to take over this lease and I'm going to open up this gallery? What did you imagine would happen and what actually happened?
Okay, this is pretty funny, but it takes me back to the time when my dad said I'm staying in art school and not going to business school, because now all of a sudden, I've opened a business.
Right.
And, you know, what the heck do I do now? And how am I going to, you know, make this come together? And I really did it all by the seat of my pants. Just by, I do have some, just maybe my art advertising background. I have some basic understanding of advertising, marketing, business, and I also have the fortitude to look at an opportunity and say, you know what, just go for it and keep going for it and try to, you know, keep enough balls in the air and whatever to make things happen and not to, you know, I'm glad I didn't just run away from it. So I gave it a go and it's still going. I did, you know, find out as I went along, I needed to have somebody to handle all the books because I'm not a bookkeeper. Mm-hmm. And I can't keep track of all that paperwork and still paint. And I needed to have a salesperson. I can't be in here all the time because now I find I'm talking with people all day long. I'm not getting any work done, you know.
And this gallery thing's really interfering with my studio time.
Totally. And I have to have paintings to sell. How am I going to do that if I'm in here, you know, chatting all the time? So for the first couple of years, I had my studio there still. But then as I got more artists and we were having – you know, lots of shows and things, I realized I had to get my stuff out of the way. I kind of kick myself out of there and let it be autonomous. And, but I did learn that you do have to constantly be doing shows, events, things to get people to go, oh, I don't want to miss that. You know, I'm going to put that on my calendar. And in Newport Beach, there's a lot to do. You know, people have beautiful homes and beautiful boats and they do have money to spend on art, which is wonderful. Thank you. Thank God for that. And, but you have to figure out how to get them out of their beautiful kitchens and, you know, out of the yacht club or wherever it is.
To come to the gallery, right. Or off the beach.
The little gallery that could on Balboa Island, I say we're small, but mighty. So it turned out, you know, it's working. I do have like kind of a staff of four people and we do have to make, you know, quite a lot of sales throughout the year to make sure everything comes together. And
yeah,
we have all sorts of things going on all the time. So it's good. It's all good.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's very, very fulfilling both because, you know, you have the ability to show your own work, but you also have the ability to, you know, introduce people to other artists' work and to sort of promote other people, which is, you know, kind of a nice feeling, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and this is kind of a message to every artist that you really kind of always have to be doing something that people take interest in. And you really shows up nowadays in social media, you know, with Facebook and Instagram and all these different things. You have to kind of have something to say and have confidence in yourself and, you know, moving forward with everything you do. So in the gallery, we constantly want to present new work in an exciting way and keep the whole art world, you know, we kind of become a community service.
Yeah.
Because people know that they can come here and we have lots of different, we even have a plein air event in the summer. So it's
how fun.
I know. There's a lot going on. And then I have to make sure I try to fit in all those openings for other artists. We try to fit them in between all my travels because I'm doing lots of, you know, plein air shows. So I'm gone a lot.
Yeah.
Painting and stuff like that. So luckily between me and Linda, we've kind of gotten a nice balance and works out.
Yeah. I like the way that you've got, you know, things, you've got your priorities very clear and you have created a structure that supports that.
Yes. Yes. Now the only tricky thing about, you know, the art business and every artist experiences this too, is you never know when someone's going to buy and not going to buy.
Right. So
it's not like you can have a budget.
Right.
I mean, we have a general budget based on our years of being in business, but you know, so you have to find ways to always, you know, that's why we always have events because there's so many ups and downs. You know,
yeah.
There might be nothing happening for 2 weeks. And you're like, where'd everybody go? And then all of a sudden it's like things are popping, you know, and there's people coming in and they want commissions and they want you to look for this painting. And how about that artist? And you know, and so
beast or famine.
Yeah, totally.
So. What, so since you have your feet in both worlds, what do you think, what are the common mistakes that artists make when, you know, like, let's say an emerging artist makes with galleries?
Well, the first thing is you want to look for a gallery that has work similar to what you do,
mm-hmm.
so that their clientele can relate you know, and the people in the gallery also want to see that you're reliable, consistent. You're now, you have to make sure you're also marketing your own work on social media. That makes a big difference as interest to a gallery. But I have to say the most important thing besides being talented artists and having some great work is that you have to be nice. And you have to be fun to be around, and you have to be easy to get along with. Because people don't have time to work with people that are hard to work with. It's like, you know what? Enough of that person. Let's work with so-and-so because they're just so wonderful to be around and you know, can't do enough with them and for them because they're so grateful and so on. So,
yeah,
you know, a positive attitude and working hand in hand. Or I can't say enough about that.
I think the thing that I hear sometimes that is kind of frustrating or sad or whatever is that there's a misconception, I think, sometimes that if you get into a gallery, you're saved and, you know, they're going to do all the work for you. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, I think that as an artist, you have a right to expect something from the, you know, that the gallery is going to promote the shows and do their part to promote the shows. But the artist also has, you know, a lot of responsibilities. And I think that, like, this, you know, idea that the gallery is sort of your employee.
Oh,
kind of true, but not really. It's a partnership.
They're your partners. And if you're not giving or if they're not, you know, then you just need to find the best way. How can I help you sell my work?
Right.
You know, what can I do? Or they should be, you know, what, let's set up something. Let's get you here, you know, to be with our customers again. And let's, you know, create a little presentation or, you know, it really is hand in hand. I mean, you want to make sales, they want to make sales, and everybody needs to be working together.
Yeah. And asking a lot of questions too. Like, what do you, what do your collectors respond to? Yeah. How can I help you?
Yeah. How can I help? What have you been hearing? You know, does everybody hate the fact that I use so much blue? I mean, whatever, you know, and maybe I could, you know, try this. And it's hard. It's just such a hard, you know, cause you always hear to the galleries and I get this from my, from Linda, you know, well, this sells and I need to do more of this. And I'm like, I've done that so many times. I can't possibly find another way to do it that makes me excited about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, but then of course I realized, well, I haven't had a sale in quite a while. Maybe I should listen to what she's saying. So, I mean, you kind of have to find a balance. So it is a compromise. Sometimes I want to be focusing on growing and trying these more masterful works of this, that, or the other thing. You know, and she might be wanting local scenes. And so it's like, oh my God, it's really hard to figure out. And here it's my own, you know, business. And I still have the same problems that I think every artist runs into, the same thing. So
yeah,
everybody's just trying to do the best they can. And you just want to form a good relationship too, so that you're not being taken advantage of either way. So work together.
Yeah. Yeah. Your partners.
Can't we all just get along? It's funny. I mean, because it's hard to. So I go to plein air shows, you know, and plein air shows. Sometimes there's the artists that all they do is bitch and complain and whine about everything. And, you know, I don't have time even for that. Just because I'm there, I'm competing, I'm enjoying.
Yeah.
You know, I like to take this positive attitude and be grateful for everything that they're doing on my behalf. Rather than, you know, there's two kinds of people. The other person's always complaining about what they're not doing. And really, it's probably what the artist isn't doing. So it's just like you got to wake up and realize that respect, gratitude, gratefulness, you know, all that stuff, opportunity, all works together. And,
yeah.
And having a positive attitude is of utmost importance. And a smile on your face and fun to be around really makes a big, big difference. And, you know, it's going to make your life a lot happier and better, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the personal responsibility. I think it kind of comes down to that. You know, I think when people are really pessimistic or really kind of have that complaining about everything attitude, usually what, you know, I find the types of things that they're saying are, I don't like this because so-and-so did, or this, you know, nothing is within their control. It's like their life is controlled by everybody outside of them. And so they're completely miserable. But when you understand that you have, you have choices
right.
of what you participate in or don't participate in and what yeah. you, you know, how you react to things, those are all choices that you get to make. And that of, and just knowing that and empowering yourself with that is, I mean, I think that's why, I don't know, to me at least, like I get so excited and I'm, you know, my husband's always teasing me that I'm like a puppy and so optimistic all the time, but, but it's just kind of like, cause I feel like, you know, like I get to decide what my life is like and I'm not going to choose to be miserable.
Yeah. You know what? And Therese, that's how you started this whole podcast thing. You just said, oh, look, this can be done. I'm going to give it a shot. And it was probably scary to get started. And look at what you've done. You know, you should be really proud of yourself. And that's based on your positive attitude. So way to go, girl.
Thank you, Deb.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to hear about what you're working on now. What are you currently obsessed with?
Well, my big obsession right now is I'm really interested in boats, old working boats. And it's because all the new boats are fiberglass and steel. And so to find the historic boats that the people that really went out to the water, the watermen to catch, you know, the oysters and the fish and the food for everybody. And they went out, you know, risked their lives on these open seas and they adventured from one, you know, coast and country to another and to deserted islands. And the whole thing just fascinates me. And I want to try to find a way to capture as many of those historic boats as possible, because after painting in Easton at the Easton Plein Air, I see that a lot of those boats melt into the sea or they're taken apart because, you know, it's too expensive to restore them.
Right.
And so, you know, one day, maybe 200 years from now, there might be hardly anywhere to be found. And so I'm really fascinated with that whole thing. I must have been in the Navy or in my past life. I must have been on a ship or something. But
a seafarer.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really fascinated with that. And if I could do any project I wanted to, you know, it would be, and I didn't have to worry about my structural life right now.
Yeah, like if you don't have to worry about time or money or anything.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'd love to travel from all over the world by people maybe sending me information on Facebook or something to come capture this port, this ship, you know, and do a book and do a show or a movie or something where people come together to talk about all this history, because there's so much involved too. You know, with the oystermen in Florida and Maryland and all along the coast there and the oysters disappearing and the fish. I mean, there's so much the sea and keeping the sea, you know, clean and just so much to talk about within that one subject.
It's, yeah.
It's worlds and worlds of information. And so that's what interests me most.
Oh, that sounds so exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. So I want to ask you one last question and then I'll let you go. What single habit do you have that you think contributes most to your success as an artist?
I'd have to say it is looking at things as though they are opportunities. So instead of a challenge, say, for instance. So I'm often seeing opportunities to do things like I was saying to you, you did about the podcast. I think that's a good part of my success and outlook, is looking at any kind of a challenge as an opportunity and, you know, using that to move into new areas maybe that I haven't been or that I'm afraid to try or whatever like that. So, and positive attitude for sure, habit. So it's not really a habit, but it's an outlook. And I have a habit of having that outlook.
So I think they overlap. It. I think that's a good answer. Yeah. Very cool. Deb, thank you so much for talking with me. That was really fun.
Oh, it's been really fun. We have to get together and go paint.
Yes, let's. I would love to.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on your show. And I'll look forward to listening to as many of the podcasts as I can. Now I hear how much fun they are. It's wonderful what you're doing for people. And we all really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Deborah for taking the time to talk to me. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. You can see examples of Deborah's work and find out about her workshops in the show notes at savvypainter.com. And while you're there, make sure you don't miss an episode. Get yourself on the list by checking on that big yellow button in the sidebar. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.